RadioInfluence.com.
He got him
in the white trunks.
He heard it.
That's beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top. Wow.
Hey, here's Lucas Amici.
And it's all over. It's
nice.
All over. First round knockout.
Big.
He's out. Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the September 12th edition of the MMA Report podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Foy. Come up here on this week's edition of the podcast. We're going to recap what happened last Saturday night in Dallas at UFC 228. Going to talk about the failed drug test by Blair Tugman for Bellator 207. Michael Chiesa has filed a lawsuit against Conor McGregor. We'll talk about that one. Plus, we're going to have four interviews for you. Going to be you'll hear my conversations with Eddie Cha, who is the head striking coach at the MMA Lab out in Arizona. Talk to Adam Borix, who's going to be fighting at next week's Bellator card up in Boise. Also hear from Pat Pitlick, who's going to be fighting for the welterweight title. Come up here in 2 weeks at Unified MMA 34. Also, we'll talk to Bram Moreau, who's going to be a part of Combat Zone card coming up next weekend up in the Northeast. Plus, we'll preview Saturday's UFC Moscow, and we'll wrap up this week's podcast by doing our buy-sell segment. Daniel, how you doing, man?
Jason, I am doing quite well. How are you doing? How are you doing fresh off your trip to New Orleans, Louisiana?
I'm doing all right, doing all right. Caught a little bit of cold the other day, but had a great time in New Orleans. Had some great food, great, very exciting game between the Bucks and the Saints on Sunday. Bucks walked away with a victory, so that was makes the trip really good when the Bucks walk away with a victory. Really a really fun game on Sunday, just kind of a back and forth, very offensive minded football. But yeah, man, had a great time.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I saw some things you ate and the amount of things you ate, and the fact that you're sick does not surprise me as we record this into next week. But congratulations on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers looking good week one. And I tell you what, it was a good week. You know, not for me as a Texans fan because they looked kind of bad against the Patriots, but for me as an MMA fan because, like, last week when I ordered UFC 228, it was a pleasant experience. A lot of times lately when I've been ordering pay-per-views, I've felt like, man, that bill's going to be rough at the end of the month. But I felt like watching UFC 228, Jason, I really got my money worth. I really thoroughly enjoyed that entire card.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, obviously there wasn't a ton of buzz heading into this event, but you know, from top to bottom, from the fight pass prelims all the way to the main card on pay-per-view, this fight card absolutely delivered. If you sat there and paid $65 on pay-per-view, you have absolutely zero complaints about it. Of course, this fight card did take a change on weigh-in day as Nico Montano admitted to the hospital due to weight-cutting issues, and of course, her title defense against Valentina Shevchenko did not happen. And once again, UFC, if you're going to strip a fighter of a title, before you rush to announce this to the media, before you rush to announce this on social media, how about you tell the fighter? Because once again, are you effing kidding me? The fighter finds out via social media that they're being stripped of their title.
That's so lame. That's so awful. And it's like, I feel like the way we've been talking about Nico Montano for a long time, I kind of want to change the tone because at the end of the day, she did win the championship. And we kind of maybe criticized the fact that clearly she wasn't the best fighter in the division. But at the end of the day, this is a person who was put in a position and she succeeded. She won the championship and she has faced an insane amount of bad luck when it comes to injuries as champion. She isn't ducking anyone. She's a high-level mixed martial arts fighter, maybe not the level of Valentina Shevchenko, but at the end of the day, you got to feel bad for her, right? It's not like she's ducking opponents. And the idea that a fighter would find out that they were being stripped of a championship via social media is insane. Like, I understand if you're an organization and you're doing like a major announcement that affects like 450 fighters, you may not be able to reach out to all of them, but you've only got like 11 champions. I feel like it's fairly easy to send a communique with Nico Montano. It seems like a big deal. And when you do things like that, not only is it awful fighter relations, but it also kind of makes your championship seem not very important. You can just strip championships willy-nilly without context, without consistency. I almost feel as though if you were going to strip Nico Montoya of the title, which we can get into whether or not that was a decision that logically makes sense in terms of having any kind of consistency with stripping people and whatnot, I think it would have been fair to wait until the Valentina Shevchenko's next fight was announced to announce that that was, in fact, for the new championship. But, yeah, Jason, all in all, my general takeaway from the UFC 228 happenings regarding Montoya was I felt pretty bad for her, and I thought the UFC did not handle it well at all.
You know, one of the things that the UFC put out, what was it, 2, maybe 3 years ago, maybe a little less, was about how they wanted fighters, when they check in, you know, into the fighter hotel the week of the fight, they want fighters to be within 8% of their weight. Well, Nico Montoya was on the MMA Hour on Monday with Luke Thomas and said that when she checked in, she was 144 pounds. That's 15.2% above her weight class. So, I mean, yes, you have to put a lot of this on Nico Montoya, and there's several aspects to talk about this of maybe, look, I think the UFC tried to rush her into this fight on this date because that was what was best for them. But I really wonder if there was ever kind of an audit done on the UFC, how many fighters would be above that 8%? Because, you know, I see both sides of this story, of Nico's side, and I also see the UFC side, and there's faults on both sides of the story. But when you hear Nico Montoya saying how much she weighed and to where, obviously, you know, she had to go to the hospital, I look at the UFC and say, the UFC's got to look at themselves in the mirror. And once again, I see stuff like this, I see stories like this, and I go, it's going to take something, a tragedy, for the UFC to understand they have to make changes.
Yeah, and the 8% is an ideal idea, but the idea that a fighter that's fighting at 125 shows up at 135 pounds, just 10 pounds over their weight cut, man, that's a nice world we live in there, Jason, because that's just not common for 125ers. And I think that extends to each division. I think some fighters clear that toll, but it is worth noting that Montoya was a bit higher than 8%. You're talking about a significant amount, and that is something that is different than an injury, when it's a weight cutting related illness or going to the hospital. That is something that you can point some aspects of that, or most of the aspects of that, to self-inflicted. So that's maybe where you have a little less sympathy for Montoya, and I can understand that. It is a situation where it does feel like a game of Russian roulette, where every fighter plays this game. Every fighter, or not every fighter, most fighters play this game. And you never know if you're going to be the one that suffers the consequences of doing something that is clearly outdated, something that is clearly not long for the sport. As you mentioned, it seems clear that there needs to be something done here. And I feel like people are really thinking about it. They've really thought about it. They've put up plans. And I don't necessarily know what the solution is. I think we're heading towards the right direction. But clearly, as we saw, the co-main event at UFC 228 is down, and a major culprit is not only Montoya, but kind of the culture of the sport when it comes to weight cutting. Had we not had that culture, we probably would have had that championship fight.
You mentioned about, Nico being stripped and would other champions being stripped. I'll give an example of this. You know, there's a lot of speculation that Max Holloway will defend the featherweight title in December in Toronto, not been officially announced against Brian Ortega, but that seems to be the fight's going to happen. Let's say Max, for whatever reason, doesn't make it to fight night. Does the UFC strip Max Holloway?
Man, that's a good question, and I don't think so. I don't. I think the UFC strips fighters based on the marketability of them and the marketability of the fights they can do with them moving forward. That, to me, is the actual logic between what I see. Because when I see Nico Montoya, if Nico Montoya was a bigger star, I think she still has her championship. If she was more highly rated inside the cage, I think she still keeps her more championship. Because the thing is, like, here's the thing. Have we not already seen Max Holloway? I guess the difference is that, oh, wait, yeah, okay, yeah. Here's the thing is, like, Max Holloway was going to fight Brian Ortega, and he pulled out. And the thing is, both him and Montano have last won their titles, like, at the exact same time. That's the last time they fought. Excuse me. Last time Max Holloway fought, December 2nd, 2017. He goes to fight Brian Ortega at UFC 226, pulls out, still has his championship. Last time Montano fought, December 1st, 2017, she gets her title stripped. So I just feel like Max Holloway probably won't get his title stripped unless there's like two or three or four top tier featherweights that are clearly above and beyond. And I don't think that's the case, man. I just think what happened here was Nico Montano wasn't a big star, wasn't a fighter that maybe fans believed in, and so they decided to treat her differently than they would someone like Max Holloway.
I love what you said there about it. It's about the superstar marketability, and you know Nico really has never she's never gotten a push from the UFC, and I think that plays into it. So we'll see what happens with the 125 pound title. My this is just my pure guess with it. I think they're going to do Shevchenko, Joanna for the 125 pound title. That's my guess. It wouldn't shock me if that's you know, on that, you know, New York card in November. I mean, that's a card that needs a main event, so we'll see it happen. Well, let's actually talk about the fights that actually did take place at 228. And, you know, one of the things we always like to talk about is biggest takeaways from the fight card. And to me, I think one of my biggest takeaways and also biggest surprises that happened on this fight card is the fact that Darren Till did not land one significant strike in this matchup. He only landed one strike. He was 1 for 7, where Tyron Woodley landed 74 total strikes, 57 significant strikes. To me, that is the part that if you would have told me heading this one that Darren Till is not going to land a significant strike, I would have said you're nuts.
That is absolutely insane. I actually didn't know that. I think I read that Carla Esparza didn't land a single significant strike in her fight, in her three-round fight. But the fact that Till didn't, and as I reflect back on that main event, I can't really recall a significant strike from Darren Till, so that does add up. Man, I had two takeaways watching this fight. The first takeaway is, man, Tyron Woodley has never looked better. Number two. Man, Tyron Woodley looks really good when he takes on guys who probably shouldn't get title shots. Like, those are my two takeaways. Like, maybe Darren Till was rushed into this situation, Jason. I mean, it was clear to me that Tyron Woodley was head over heels above Darren Till. And the fact that, like, there was a point in time where Woodley was an underdog heading into that fight, oh my gosh, with the benefit of hindsight, doesn't that come across as so stupid? It just watching those two guys in the cage, Jason. One guy was a championship level fighter. The other guy is like a solid top 10 welterweight. There was just a major solid top 10 middleweight. There was just a major difference in the skill level between these two guys. And when it was on the feet, Woodley was better. When it was on the ground, Woodley was better. This was probably one of the top performances we've seen out of Tyron Woodley.
And Darren Till will grow for this. I love the video the UFC put out there where backstage Woodley goes up to him and he talks about his losses and how that made him a better fighter. And Darren Till is going to grow, you know, from this. And, you know, look, it's going to set up, you know, Woodley versus Covington. But before we get to that, heading into this fight, you know, Tyron Woodley was mentioning the fact of, you know, being the greatest welterweight champion of all time. And when you start... I don't know that I'm ready to make that statement that he's the greatest welterweight champion of all time, UFC welterweight champion of all time. He's definitely in the conversation. I would still say GSP. But when you look at the resume that Tyron Woodley has put together, there's a damn good case to make that claim.
Oh, dude, he is climbing up the ranks. What he needs, I think, are fights like the Colby Covington fight, and he needs guys to make names. Look, at the end of the day, if Tyron Woodley wins his next 10 fights, he's going to be the greatest welterweight of all time. He probably only needs to win about five more or something like that, three more, something like that. That's all he really needs. But when I'm looking at his resume, Jason, to me, the two things he's missing is just a multitude of super dominant victories. He has a few, the win over Lawler, the win over Till, but he's missing that. He may start getting those. And also, the other thing, when you kind of contrast his resume with GSP's, the other thing he's missing, I think, are those big name victories. I don't know. When I look down, I see Till, Maya, Thompson, Lawler, Gastelum, Duncan, Kim. Although Kim and Gastelum aren't title fights, the only name that sticks out to me is Robbie Lawler of those wins. So I feel like obviously GSP does have the benefit of his wins happened a while ago. So all those fighters he did fought had the benefit of having careers afterwards. But I think a lot of those guys GSP fought were bigger names heading into those fights. So I think that's the advantage GSP has over Woodley. But Woodley, all he needs to do is go in the cage and win and win and win and win, and he's going to get that mantle. This was not a discussion I was ever prepared to have when Tyron Woodley won the welterweight championship. I thought this guy was really talented, but I also didn't necessarily think this guy was going to be a dominant welterweight champion. And this man has held the title since July 2016. He's defended it four times, three victories. But this was, to me, the first time since he won the championship where you looked at Tyron Woodley inside the cage and you said unequivocally, this is one of the best fighters on the planet.
And a very cool moment of him getting his black belt in the cage, which makes you wonder, how many fights has that black belt potentially been in the bag heading into it that they were waiting for that submission win? So but very cool moment there. And you saw the emotions for Tyron Woodley. I mean, obviously, it's going to set up Woodley versus Covington. And, you know, and look, one of the things that I was taught early on in sports radio is you never talk politics and sports. But why do I feel like Colby Covington is going to bring politics into sports? Because we use sports as an outlet to get away from what's going on in politics. But I just get this feeling that Colby Covington is going to bring politics into this fight.
I mean, it's probably a big part of his life. And it's also, if we're looking at this away from be inside the political realm, regardless of what mine and your political viewpoints are, I think when we look at our society today, I think we recognize two things. And Colby's not looking at it like this, but I don't think. But we recognize two things. One is that more people are aware about politics than ever before in our society. And two, politics is almost like this weird type of celebrity. I don't know. And the thing I would say is the idea that Colby Covington is wrapped inside this thing, you know, the first UFC fighter to ever go to the White House, you know, it could theoretically bring in eyeballs. It could also cause people to love him, and it could cause people to absolutely despise him. You know, politics is a very real thing, what's going on. But in the pomp and circumstance that is combat sports, bringing it in isn't the worst thing in the world, because it does generate for the viewer, based on your political standpoint, a good guy or a bad guy. And you know, you can certainly enjoy the theater of that as we use this almost as a distraction. It's not something you want to see every single fight card. In fact, you probably don't want to see it in any fight card. You don't watch your sports for your politics. But in this one specific case, I'm slightly intrigued to see what transpires, because Colby Covington has definitely done something that no UFC fighter has ever done, go to the White House. I think he picked the right president to go towards, because I think this is a situation where, you know, he's open to people that support him. And I think Woodley versus Covington is going to be a fight that is going to be the most entertaining before the bell actually rings, because I tell you what, the pre-fight hype is going to be great. It's probably going to get nasty. It's going to get uncomfortable. We're going to have to dance around topics, but I'm certainly looking forward to the pre-fight hype. And I really do hope that both these guys get a main event slot. And I really hope the amount of trash talking they do does good business, because I would like to see Woodley be on top of a pay-per-view that does good business. I would like to see a UFC pay-per-view that does good business, that doesn't have Connor or Ronda or Jones on it. And I think this might actually happen. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I would love to see the UFC actually, go all in on Tyron Woodley. I mean, obviously, I'm sure you've probably seen people talking about kind of the face reactions Dana White had, as he's about to put the belt on Tyron Woodley. There was a clip from the weigh-in show on Friday where my perception of it was, I think that Dana White wanted Darren Till to win. I think they wanted a European champion to potentially do another big fight card over in the UK. But just an unbelievable performance by Tyron Woodley. Also, talk about an unbelievable performance, Jessica Andrade. Apologies to Jessica Andrade, man. I doubted her last week on the podcast. And what just you look at that, 118 seconds we saw between those two ladies. Man, that was a fun fight to watch. And, you talk about the lack of significant strikes that Darren Till was able to land. But then when you look at both of those ladies, Andrade landing 38, Colby Kavish 24, it was very early on in that fight where I want to say it was a right hand that Andrade landed. That I just felt that Carolina just never recovered from. And she was just, trying to get her wits about her. And then just an amazing knockout by Jessica Andrade. I think that Jessica clearly makes her case as being next up for Rose Namajunas. To me, that definitely is a fight to make. And, of course, Carolina, let's see how she bounces back in this one. But, man, did not see this going the way it did. And kudos to Jessica Andrade.
Oh, dude, that was one of the best knockouts I think I've ever seen in a women's fight, for sure. That was brutal. That was the idea that two people weighing 115 pounds could one person weighing 115 pounds could create a knockout like that. Oh, Jessica Andrade looks scary. I mean, she's probably going to fight. No, she should fight Rose. Like, there is no alternative. Like, this, a lot of times when you see top-level contenders in a specific division, they sometimes leave things out on the table. Rivera, John Dodson, for example. Jessica Andrade is a top contender, possible challenger. She went out and she went and grabbed her opportunity, man. I mean, there is, to me, no one that watched this card that doesn't want to see her get in the cage with Rose Namajunas. She looked like a world beater. Again, best performance of her career. I was stupid for picking Kovacevic. That was clear early on. Andrade is just the amount of danger she provides when she's on the feet, unleashing her strikes. It's a sight to behold. She, to me, is now appointment viewing television. She is so powerful to see someone at 115 pounds strike the way she does with the amount of power she does. She's a threat. And again, you feel bad for Kovacevic because, by God, that will be on many highlight reels. A phenomenal knockout by Jessica Andrade, Jason.
Also on this main card, we had Zabit Magomedsharipov get a submission win in the second round against Brandon Davis, Jimmy Rivera, decision win over John Dodson, and Abdulrazik Al-Hassan with a knockout win against Nico Price. Magomedsharipov, obviously, he's looking for a big fight, Chad Mendes. I want to see a step up in competition for Magomedsharipov. Of course, he was supposed to fight Yair Rodriguez right here, but I do wonder, is taking on potentially Chad Mendes next maybe too steep up in competition for him?
It would be a massive jump up from Brandon Davis to Chad Mendes. There's a pretty big gap there, but watching Magomedsharipov four fights into his UFC career, Jason, why not? I mean, if he fails, he fails. He can always rebound and recover. But I think when you go in, you win four consecutive UFC fights, maybe not against the best competition. A fight against Chad Mendes would be a stretch, but watching Zabit fight and watching him so clearly outclass his opponents, it feels like a stretch that we've seen before in the UFC, where we have seen these prospects come in and then sooner rather than later get thrown into the lion's den. But again, Chad Mendes, elite of the elite level featherweight, it may be smarter to bridge that gap. But it was an interesting little call out. And I will say this, talking about the finish of this fight and the finish of the Aljamain Sterling Cody Stamann fight. So the submission these guys pulled off were basically identical. And the way I would describe it is like they have like their groin on like the neck of their opponent and they like grab the foot and they like bring it towards the face. it's pretty unorthodox. And the funny thing about this is that if you're a wrestling fan, you would recognize this as the stump puller, which was the finishing move of Doink the Clown. So these two guys busted out the finishing move of famous WWE wrestler Doink the Clown in UFC 228. This is a submission I don't really ever see. It's a very unorthodox way of doing the knee bar. So, I would think if you're going to steal a finishing move from a WWE wrestler, it'd be Brock Lesnar or The Undertaker or John Cena. Not necessarily Doink the Clown, but it appears 20-some years later, Doink the Clown was very sound when it came to his jiu-jitsu game, because that to me is kind of an embarrassing way to lose a fight the way these dudes did to that type of knee bar.
Yeah, it's I talk about results that surprised me, and it's not that she won. It's in the matter of how she won, and Tatiana Suarez. I mean, she may be the female version of Khabib Nurmagomedov. I mean, what a beatdown she put on Carla Esparza. I mean, I thought that Tatiana was a win, but I did not expect to see that domination that she showed.
Yeah, dude, my thought process watching that fight was immediately watching Tatiana Suarez. I was like, Jesus, this lady is unbelievable. And she fought like it. She fought a former champion in Carla Esparza, and this was domination. I mean, she absolutely smothered her, landed significant amount of strikes, and was able to get the finish. And my second thought was more looking at the women's strawweight division. And, man, I look at that division, I'm like, man, if Ioana stayed in this division, we're talking about one of the more compelling top portions of a UFC division in a while. Because if you look at it, even without Ioana, you have your champion Rose, man, and that top three is pretty good with Andrade, Claudia Gadella, and Tatiana Suarez. You know, watching Suarez fight, watching Andrade fight, that got me really excited for the women's strawweight division. And I think that's good for them. And I think Tatiana Suarez, Andrade, Claudia, and Rose, I think they're going to set up for some great fights moving forward, Jason. But today, Tatiana and Jessica Andrade clearly showcased there is a massive gap between them and us, pretty much the rest of the women's strawweight division.
You mentioned about knockouts, Jeff Neal's knockout against Frank Camacho, Darren Stewart come from behind victory. Of course, you got to mention Diego Sanchez and Jim Miller, the old dogs going out there and getting a victory. And then the women's bantamweight matchup between Irene and Lucy, just an unbelievable women's matchup. If you haven't seen that one, go on your Fight Pass account. That was a great fight.
Oh, dude, yeah. You got to watch that fight. That fight was awesome. Like, oh my gosh. Pudilova, Adana, probably the best fight of the year I've seen so far this year. A phenomenal firefight. One of the best fights, you know, if you're doing a top 100 fights in UFC history, that one's definitely in it. And it was great. It was phenomenal. Great way to start the card. Absolutely worth the money for Fight Pass. A couple notes. Don't really understand how Roberto Sanchez won one car against Jared Brooks. That was stupid. I saw that, and I did not understand. Brooks clearly won that fight. In terms of biggest surprises, I guess it would be the old dogs, Jim Miller and Diego Sanchez, returning to form, looking good, looking dominant. These weren't close fights. Diego clearly beat Craig White. And more surprisingly, the way Jim Miller put away Alex White so quickly. That to me was the biggest shocker of a card, really, when you look on the pre-fight odds and what transpired. Weren't too many surprises, but to me the biggest surprises were Jim Miller and Diego Sanchez once again getting their hands raised inside the UFC cage.
And it was, you know, as we said, overall just a great fight card this past Saturday night. But of course, the UFC train does roll on. They are now in Moscow. We'll talk about that event here later on in the podcast. I do want to mention a story that I had last week. Blair Tugman, who was scheduled to be a part of the Bellator show at the Mohegan Sun on October 12th, he is no longer a part of this fight card as he was failed his out of competition drug test, tested positive for a steroid. He has been suspended 1 year and fined $1,200. I can tell you after I post this story, whether it was seeing comments online or talking to people in that Northeast scene. I will tell you, majority of the responses were not surprised. I did see a comment online basically saying that Blair volunteered this drug test, which that is not the case. He was told that he had to take the drug test. I will say one of the things that became clear to me was I think there's some people in the Northeast scene that don't understand that once you are licensed and you will have a bout agreement signed that you can be drug tested at any moment. And of course I got all this information about the positive drug test from Mike Mazzulli, and there's been a lot of out of competition drug testing going on for that Bellator car, which it is a great thing. And also I think it's going to send a big message to anyone up there in the Northeast. But, I think for Bellator, this is, you hate to see one of your fighters, test positive for a banned substance. And of course, also a fighter that does sell you a good amount of tickets. But, I think this is a good thing that shows that drug testing is taking place in Bellator.
Yeah, man, it is a good thing. God, looking at Blair Tugman again, just going through Google images, it's hard not to look at him and be suspicious. I mean, this dude looks great, but he's got a lot of veins popping out. And look, I'm not a body guy. I look in the mirror and I look like I took whatever the opposite of steroids is. But geez, this guy looks like he had a little help when it comes to the gym. So the deal is, though, plenty of guys look like they're on the juice, or they're taking performance enhancing drugs, or they're taking an illegal substance, and they're not. Sometimes they are. That's why you do the testing and the process work on a preliminary card of a Bellator is pretty sweet, just because I don't know if we have the same standards for Bellator preliminary card as we do for other promotions for the UFC. And that makes sense, because to me, it's like follow the money. You know, when you have a lot of money, when you make a big profit, you should do testing. And for Bellator, I think they're right on the peripheral, and to see the fact of, a test this far in advance, I think it's pretty sweet. And this wasn't something that was voluntary. Blair Tugman did not go to Mike Mazzulli and say, "Hello, Mike, I would like to get tested for drugs." This was something that he was asked to do, and he failed. So hopefully the dude gets clean, returns back to sport in a year, gets it going on. Last time we saw him, he lost to AJ McKee, and I'm sure we'll see him again. Don't know if we'll see him in Bellator or not, but I'm sure the thing is, like, if you see these names constantly on the Bellator prelims, that means one of two things: he's a prospect or he sells a lot of tickets. I'm sure Tugman sells a lot of tickets, and if he does that, he'll be back, but he's just got to keep it clean.
Yeah. So, but another big story over the past couple of days came out on Tuesday. Michael Chiesa files a lawsuit, civil lawsuit against Conor McGregor. Look, you can go to any MMA website. You can actually see the lawsuit. The lawsuit was filed on Monday in a New York courtroom where this lawsuit is against McGregor. And also against the Barclays Center as well, which is kind of interesting, where Chiesa has levies a half a dozen claims against McGregor and the co-defendants Barclays Center and the parent company BSE Global and the unnamed persons for negligent infliction of emotional distress, assault, battery, intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligent hiring, retention, and supervision, and respondent superior. This is an interesting lawsuit because I kind of sit here and in business, I always talk about what is the end game. And for Michael Chiesa, and I saw this great tweet on Monday or Tuesday about this lawsuit, and I want to read the tweet here. It said, quote, "With the news of Chiesa's lawsuit against McGregor, I don't think anything comes of it. His severe emotional distress, mental trauma, and or bodily harm may have prevented him from fighting on April 7th, but not from agreeing to rebook on April 30th for UFC 26. Shouldn't have fought," and that was from at Secret Moves MMA on social media. But I think the big thing that I look at is, if I'm Michael Chiesa, and is, what happens if Conor McGregor goes to the UFC and says, "I want this guy out of the UFC"? Is the lawsuit worth it?
I mean, no. That would be a hard no. It's not worth it. You're probably not going to get enough money to supplement what you would make in the UFC. that would be, I mean, it would be fairly transparent if we see Connor return and Kies is cut. I think there would be outrage over it. I think there's enough checks and balances in place to prevent that from happening. But it is a gamble for Michael Chiesa to do that, to poke the bear. I mean, Connor is the big bear in the MMA world. But, I mean, if you look at it from his perspective, like, the one just from, like, a money perspective, Connor McGregor's got a lot of money. And there's a good chance early on his camp is just going to want to settle these things. So you can get a little bit of change. And I can see that as a human being who has to pay bills and stuff, that you look at this as an opportunity to get some money. When you look at the charge or you know, what he's got, like emotional distress, that one's hard to prove. Like, hey, if any fighter can get money for emotional distress, I know Rose Namajunas should go for that. Because Jesus, dude, you Google Rose Namajunas' name, September 2018, there's articles about how she still doesn't leave her house and still struggling after the bus attack. Damn. What the hell, Connor? That's messed up. You're a jerk. Also, that showcases emotional distress. Whereas, and even though she did fight, like, you know, on that Saturday, I mean, you do look at Chiesa. He did accept a fight at a later date in a short period of time. So that probably hurts his case, Jason. And there is great risk, because you are poking a bear against maybe the top bully in the sport. But I think from his perspective, there's a great likelihood that Connor's camp just settles people who sue him real quickly and he get a little chunk of change.
Look, does Connor sit there and say, all right, cool, kid, we'll battle in court, and then he tries to just, you know, extend this and make Michael Chiesa's lawyer bills just something where he can't afford?
I think that's definitely a move he can play. And if Chiesa goes for it, I think it's you got to do a partnership with a lawyer that, you know, doesn't charge you until you get the payday. You know, a lawyer that's that confident, because I would assume most UFC fighters aren't in a position to be held up in court. Really, no one is. Court is way too expensive. So that is one card Connor could play. But I do wonder how involved Connor is in those type of decisions. You know, I'm sure he has a large group around him that makes those choices for him. And again, I have a general assumption that their prerogative will be just to get this thing settled real quick. So, but the thing is, if they do get settled, that is going to open the floodgates for other people to sue him.
Exactly. And that's why I think Connor doesn't settle, because if he does settle, all of a sudden, I think you see Ray Borg, you know, Rose Namajunas and others kind of pile onto this. So that's why I think you're going to see, you know, McGregor really fight this. And I just look at, you know, I mean, obviously the end game is, you know, get a settlement, but you know, in terms of your UFC career, is that what's best for you? I don't know. You know, we'll see how that, it does play out there, but it is time for the interview portion of this week's edition of the podcast. First, you're going to hear my conversation with Adam Borex, the featherweight prospect for Bellator, returns to Bellator next Friday night. He'll be a part of the preliminary card, so I had a chance to catch up with him. You'll hear that first. Then you're going to hear my conversation with Eddie Cha, who is the head striking coach at the MMA Lab. Then you'll hear from Pat Pitlick, who's going to be fighting for the welterweight title at Unified MMA 34 against Ron Phillips on September 28th. And then you're going to hear my conversation with Brandon Marat, who's going to be taking on Robert Best at Combat Zone next Saturday night up in the Northeast.
First off, Adam, you've made a great impact in Bellator here. You've won both your Bellator fights, and of course, everyone remembers that flying knee knockout that you had in your last matchup. Where does that knockout rank in terms of your greatest moments in MMA competition?
I think this knockout was my best performance in my career. This is my favorite movement. So I have another flying knee knockout in K1 fight. But I think my next opponent is a really, really good fighter. So I think this is a new step for me. So he's a other level. So that's why I can't play this fight.
in that last matchup where you had that flying knee knockout, that was your third opponent that had been booked for that fight card. So, you know, take me back to, you know, those couple of, you know, weeks leading up to that fight. Was there, would you call that kind of maybe one of the biggest challenges of your career because you went through multiple opponent changes?
I think I'm gonna make it. Nagyon akartam volna Galagárra elbúnyozni, mert most is nagyon szeretnék vele, csak hogy lement egy súlycsoportot, ezt is mondhatjuk. Igazából rossz érzés volt, de már a végén próbáltam csak fókuszálni, nem csináltunk én game plant, hogy legyen mi a taktika, hanem csak fókuszálni arra, hogy kész legyek bárkire, és nagyon akartam harcolni, szóval kicsit tartottam attól, hogy nem fogok harcolni, de egy idő után kizártam ezt a dolgot, és csak próbáltam, vártam az ellenfelet, hogy legyen valaki.
He's saying that he really wanted to fight Gallagher. He still would love to fight Gallagher, but because he was talking a lot of bad things about my country, and which is, I guess, usual thing for him. But he went down a weight category. So at that time, when these changes happened, he was very frustrated. But then him and his team, they start focusing on only getting him ready for any opponent and not for a specific opponent, and he was ready for anyone.
Anyone that has followed your career or even follows you on social media, they know you've made that transition to South Florida down there with Henry Hoof's team. What led you to decide that going to Florida was the best place for you to take your game to another level?
Because at home, I didn't have a training partner, I didn't have a coaches, so almost I trained always alone, but I know if you want to be the best, you have to train with the best guys in the world, so that's why I moved here, and it was my dream, my whole life. When I started the MMA, I know I will be the guy who changed the Hungarian MMA. So I know it. If I come, tudtam, hogyha
he knew it. If once he comes here,
akkor fel fognak szerezni, és
somebody will discover him. And this is why he thought that this is the best step for him.
You know, moving into a new country, there's obviously a lot of adjustments you have to make culturally. There's just, you know, different parts of the world. What was the biggest adjustment that you had to make when coming to the United States from being in your home country?
Igazából szerencsés vagyok, hogy vannak barátaim, a legfőbb menedzserem, akik segítettek. Nekem mindig is ez volt az álmom, hogy egy profi csapatba készüljek, hogy olyan én. Most lettem valójában profi, hogy ide költöztem, hogy tényleg csak az edzésekkel foglalkozom, de nyilván a család és a távolság az, hogy a barátok, de a távolság érzése.
He's saying that he's very lucky that he has a good friend here who helped him with the transition and his team. Basically the biggest challenge for him is to be the distance and be far away from his family, his country, and his friends. The distance is the biggest challenge.
The nickname The Kid, how did you get it?
Because I have a baby face, you know, and everybody think I'm 19 years old, so that's why this is my name.
You mentioned about your opponent here, Silva, how this was a tough fight. You realize what he brings to the cage. What do you see as his biggest strength that he's going to bring to you?
He's a good stand-up guy, and he's a brown belt in the jiu-jitsu. I think he's a dangerous fighter in striking and the ground too. But I want this. I want to...
This is what I want to be against the top guy who is good standing up and on the ground too.
Yeah.
When MMA fans hear your name, what do you want them to think of you? Is there a perception you want out there of who you are, maybe not just as a fighter, but as a person that you would want fans to know?
I'm a really hard hard worker, you know. So yeah, typical Temi Munkash.
He's a typical guy who works really hard. That's what he wants everybody to know, that he's a really hard working guy and very disciplined.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that I really got familiar with talking to Henry Corrales, because he's ultimately the reason Henry Corrales went to the lab in Arizona. It is the MMA Lab striking coach, Eddie Cha. Eddie, I appreciate the time. Really looking into your story of actually, you know, kind of your martial arts journey, of how it's you're working with Francisco Rivera over a fight in England. John Crouch is there, Benson Henderson there. They offer you a job, but you had a gym already in California. Do you ever kind of think back to those moments of like, man, where would my martial arts journey be if I wasn't working with Francisco on that day in England?
Yeah, it's crazy how everything came about and how we met and stuff like that. And even that time when we actually met up in England, Cisco didn't really like taking fights outside the country. We fought a few times in Canada, but, you know, it was actually the first time outside of the U.S. and in Canada. And so just the irony of being there and them being there on that day and then us being in the same corner, you know, they could have easily been in the blue corner. We could have been in the red. And so, it was all surreal. It happened so fast, and making the decision to actually go down and to take that job and position in Arizona, it happened literally so fast. I can't remember how many months it was, but it didn't take long. We're going back and forth. I said, no, I can't do it. I have a gym. I got guys here. My family's here. And, you know, one thing led to another. My wife and I, we prayed about it, and the doors opened so quickly. So, yeah. We ended up in Arizona.
Being a married man, I think I could probably, you know, understand that. Probably the more of was convincing your wife that this was going to be the right move more than anything else, right?
Right, absolutely. Happy wife, happy life.
Exactly.
And both of us, my wife and I, we've lived in California pretty much our whole lives. So I was in Northern California, Southern California, but nevertheless, just in California. So to move outside of California was a really huge decision change, especially leaving the gym that I started, you know, from scratch and things like that. So it was a huge move, definitely a big move.
I gotta imagine that's gotta be tough for you to start your own place, you know, a place that, you know, from the first, you know, day. Was that maybe part of the hardest decision? And kind of, you know, obviously it's worked out well for you, but was that kind of a really hard thing for you?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I've had great relationships with students, fighters, friends, and so forth. And to get up and go was a huge decision. A lot of guys were kind of surprised, shocked, and some were angry, I'm assuming, and hurt. But I had to do what was best for me and my family. And, you know, it's always been a dream of mine to actually work, you know, and I don't want to say this in the wrong way. I've worked with great athletes and great fighters, you know, in California, but to work with elite guys such as Benson Henderson and so forth. And, you know, the lab was a top 10 gym in the world, you know, so, and they still are at that point when I made that decision. And looking at the roster and the up and coming fighters and stuff like that, you know, it was a chance that I wanted to take and I had to take. And definitely my wife was a big part in it. Without her saying yes, we wouldn't have been down here, but she was super supportive. And so we made the move.
And of course, you mentioned about some of the names that are there. You know, Benson Henderson, obviously a part of the management team there at the MMA Lab. And, you know, he's been a champion, you know, at the highest level. Is there something you as a coach you see in a guy like Benson and other elite fighters inside the lab that you try to, you know, point to other fighters in the gym and say, to be great, you got to have this trait that Benson has or this guy has?
Yeah, Benson's definitely the leader here. When I moved down, he was definitely a big part of it. You know, at that point he fought Korshkov. I was kind of semi in there just, at that time we were going back and forth to Arizona, but I knew he'd get a shot at 55 at the title. And I wanted to be a part of history too. You know, he's won the WBC belt, the UFC belt, and him winning the Bellator belt. I don't think anybody's ever done that. So, that was he was definitely a big decision in my part. I've always been a fan of his, the way he carries himself, you know, not only inside and outside the ring, the cage. And so, yeah, he's the man.
MMA is an evolving game. We've seen it, you know, whether someone's been a fan of the sport for 3 years or 25 years, you've seen the evolution of the game. For you as a lifelong martial artist and now, you know, coaching fighters, how do you see the game evolving?
They're definitely more well-rounded. I know back in the days, you know, everybody was kind of a great striker or, you know, a world-class jiu-jitsu guy or, you know, a D1 wrestler or things like that. Nowadays, if you look at the younger generation, everyone wrestles in high school. They all go to college and wrestle. They're already brown belts by the time they're 20 years old and things like that. And they've all boxed or done traditional styles. So, you know, so many guys are so much more well-rounded, especially the younger generation, the guys that are in their 20s and stuff like that. They start a lot earlier. They know what they want to do. I think a lot of guys when in the older days, 20 years ago, they kind of fell into it. You know, the career chooses them as opposed to they pick the careers. But now, I think at an early age, even at the lab, you'll see kids, I want to be a UFC fighter at 10 years old or 15 years old, and they continue to do so. You know, we have a lot of guys that are homegrown. Mario Bautista, he's I'm not sure exactly when he started, but I think he was 8-0 or 9-0 as an amateur. He's taken every class all the way up, you know. He's 5-0 as a pro right now. Sean O'Malley is another product to the lab. Mackenzie Dern, they all started at 0-0. And so these are just young superstars that are just evolving the game.
I have to imagine as a coach, that's the, you know, an ideal scenario. That's the type of fighter you want to work with from the ground floor. So you're not trying to fix any bad traits that they maybe inherited from another coach, another gym. Is that the kind of way, I mean, an ideal scenario, if I can get someone who has never been in a fight, never, you know, been on a jiu-jitsu mat, that's kind of the ideal, you know, person you want to work with?
Yeah, I think there's two parts of it. Definitely, it's nice to grab somebody that has zero experience and then just get your input exactly into how you want things done and so forth. And then on the other part, someone that, say, has 5 fights, 10 fights or more, they're going to have certain habits, but they're also going to have good and bad habits too, you know. And nothing compensates experience. So it's kind of nice to have somebody that knows already what they're doing and then kind of just like giving it a tune-up, change a couple things here, modify the engine, you know, the suspensions and so forth. And especially guys with experience, they kind of appreciate some of the moves that, you know, the higher level moves that we're showing. Whereas a newer guy, he might just, if all you had was this, you don't know how great it is. You know, if you're eating steak and lobster every single day, you don't know what the struggle is of eating just canned foods or fast foods. So it's kind of both, you know.
You know, I've used the term evolve, and of course, as you have evolved as a coach, there's things you have learned throughout the years that you wish you would have known day one. For a young coach out there that's listening or watching this, what would be the best advice you would give someone who's trying to work their way up the MMA coaching game?
I would say get involved with a good mentorship program, with a good coach, good gym. You know, just learn under the tutelage of somebody that's been there, that's gone there, you know, that has a good reputation. when I was kind of starting up in California and getting into MMA, I'd always ask the top coaches. I had no ego or anything. I was always trying to learn from anybody, everyone. So Coach Paulson, I'd ask him from CSW. Coach Oyama from Team Oyama, I'd always ask him, do you have any advice? How would I grow my gym? How can I build my fighters? Even guys from Millennia, I remember Batiste, I'd always ask him too, because these are some of the top gyms in Southern California. So anytime I see them at shows, I would say, hey, can I ask you a question? How do you evolve? And, you know, they've always been generous with their time, and, you know, they'd always help me out and things like that. But yeah, first and foremost, I find a coach that's reputable, knows what they're doing, has been around the game, and that's willing to kind of, you know, put them under their wings.
It's interesting you bring up ego, because it makes me think of early on in my days in radio where, you know, I had a boss say to me, he goes, look, everyone's got an ego in radio, but you better check that ego at the door frame. Your head's got to fit through the door frame. It kind of made me kind of think about what you kind of said there is, I mean, because look, yeah. In the fight game, you know, everyone's confident, everyone. Is that something you kind of try to, you know, try to ground your fires a little bit of like, look, you know, you got to check it a little bit.
Yeah, 100%. It's nice, you know, especially at the lab, we have so many different type of fighters, you know, like there's always somebody better than you in striking. If not, there's always somebody better than you on the ground or wrestling and things like that. So if they need to be humbled, some of the veterans will kind of do that on their own. So I don't think we need to tell them to, hey, you need a little bit of humble pie, because they'll get it come sparring day, wrestling day, jiu-jitsu day, whatever day it may be. The veterans do a really good job about that.
They kind of say karma. Karma does catch up to you at some point. Yeah. You know, obviously, you mentioned there's so many great fighters there, but there's obviously a lot of up-and-coming fighters. You mentioned about Mario Bautista is a guy that I've got a chance to get to know over the past year or so. Who are some of these guys that, you know, we should be paying attention to that, you know, really just aren't getting the publicity?
Mario Bautista is definitely one. Shug, you guys already know about him. When I first saw him, I thought he was going to be a star off the bat. Who else comes to mind? Keone Diggs. He's in the LFA right now. I believe he's 5-0, 6-0. He can crack. I think he's undefeated as an amateur as well. We have Hunter. I'm trying to think of his last name, but he's from Montana. He's 3-0 right now. He was a Division I wrestler, and I think he was a 2- or 3-time state champion wrestler as well. He's a stud. We have so many guys. I can't even think off the top of my head. Kyler Phillips is another one. He was on the Ultimate Fighter show. Yeah, he's a superstar. He's a stud. We got tons of them. They're just constantly coming up, growing, evolving, and so forth. So, yeah, we're definitely producing a lot of guys out there.
And final thing here, and I really appreciate the time. You mentioned about the amateur ranks, and there's guys that go to it. There's some guys just go straight to the pros. You know, for you as a coach, is that more of an individual conversation of whether, you know, 10 sometimes is the number you hear from coaches that they want their fighters to have 10 amateur fights. For you, what's kind of your philosophy on that of when is the right time for a fighter to go pro?
I think their background, you know, have they competed in other sports? Have they competed in other types of martial arts? You know, jiu-jitsu tournaments, boxing, kickboxing matches. Age has a big a big factor to do with it. Some guys are a lot older, so they, you know, 10 fights in an amateur or a pro, that's equivalent to probably about almost 3 years, 2 years if you're really on the fast track, 2.5. And so if they're a little bit older, you know, then you got to kind of turn them loose. And also how tested are they? You know, are they just running through the amateur ranks and there's no one that wants, like some of our guys, they had a hard time getting fights, you know, in Arizona. So then we'd have to outsource them out to other states and stuff like that. If you're beating the guys over there and winning every division, then, you know, you kind of got to turn pro too. So I think it really depends on the individual, you know, the age factor, experience factor. But yeah, we definitely, you know, mostly Coach Crouch, our head coach and the owner, he talks a lot of the guys and mentors them. He does a great job of deciding. A lot of guys will want to turn pro before he thinks he's ready. And they'll say, okay, we're going to take the toughest fight out there. If you win, then, you know, we turn pro. If not, let's get one more and let's work on your weaknesses.
And Eddie, man, I really appreciate you coming on the show this week. Love the insight there. As I mentioned, I think it says a lot about you that Henry Corrales moves from California to Arizona just because of you going to the lab. So I think it says a lot about your coaching abilities, and I really appreciate it. Anywhere where my listeners can follow you out on social media?
I'm on Instagram at Eddie_CHAHA. And just Eddie Chaw on Facebook as well. I don't have a Twitter.
That may not be a bad thing. It may not be a bad thing.
Yeah, I appreciate the time. Thank you for having me.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report, man, it's going to be fighting for the Unified Welterweight title. Man, we've had on the show before, Pat Pitlick. Pat, as always, man, I appreciate the time. One of the things I saw on your Facebook page, it talked about how you're using science to help you out with the Armory Sports Science. So how did this come together?
Well, you know, you've heard me talk so many times about how I've been injured and busted up, you know, in training camp and then going into fights like 80%. So, I got wicked sponsors now. And, yeah, a team full of doctors that are helping me out at the Armory.
You know, one of the things when I saw this little basically a paragraph of what you were doing there, it kind of made me think of what goes on with UFC fighters at the UFCPI, where it's really about kind of just, you know, figuring out what is best for you, how to maximize performance. Is that essentially kind of, has there been, you know, some time working with these people that it made you kind of realize that you weren't doing things correctly to maximize performance?
Yeah, 100%. Like I got a personal trainer now. I got a nutritionist. You know, I got all sorts of just like a team full of doctors that are helping me out with all kinds of problems and getting me 100%. So, yeah, they're helping me with my. I'm training smarter. I'm eating better. It's just a different approach than what I'm used to. So it's perfect. It's helping me out, and I'm feeling good, and I'm finally going into a fight injury free.
I remember we talked about that last time where you kind of joked like, hey, you know, last time we talked, I really couldn't tell you about what was going on. You talk about that change in nutrition. Is there one piece of food item that has been taken out of your life that you're like, man, I wish I could have, you know, that just on a cheat day?
Maybe just grains, probably just grains and stuff. I take out bread, you know, when I'm getting ready to fight and stuff. More or less just to make me more miserable, probably give me that edge to want to just go out there and perform.
You know, obviously you're coming off another stoppage victory, and I guess kind of more what I kind of find the mindset of a fighter. You know, after you have a fight, you get the victory. Is it one of those things of, you know, a couple days later you watch the fight, looks at pros, cons, and then do you just totally move on?
Yeah, on to the next one. Pretty much. I enjoy life a little bit, and then yeah, on to the next one, except so that last one was short notice, right? So that that feeling that you have when you have a fight coming up, it usually goes away once you win, you know. And then, you know, you talk with your coaches, you talk to the promoters, and then you get another opponent, you get another date, another fight, and then that feeling comes back. And then see, for me, that feeling never left, because I took that fight, and then when I was in the ring, they announced I was fighting in September. Like, I didn't have an opponent exactly at the time, but the announcement was made. So I still had that feeling in my gut that, okay, like, you didn't do anything yet. Like, it hasn't left. So I've been in fight camp for, yeah, I fought on the Friday. I was back in the gym on the Monday because, I came out without any injuries, so there was no reason not to, and I didn't really get to celebrate because, you know, I felt like I'm delaying gratification to this title that I hope to accomplish and get. So
I think a lot of people naturally go, okay, this is now a title fight scheduled for two more rounds, that magically training just changes. But in talking to other fighters, they've said, no, I'm always preparing for a 25-minute fight just, you know, for when that fight just happens. So is that for you? It's just, there's not really any changes.
I think, honestly, man, I think that's kind of a cocky thing to say, you know, because you don't know that unless you've been there, right? And I can't honestly say that I've been there, so I don't know if I can do 25 minutes, but I'm training my ass off to increase the probability of me fighting for 25 minutes, you know. Like I've been, like I said, I was back in training camp on the Monday after I fought on the Friday. Because of that fear of can I actually do 25 minutes, you know? So yeah, I don't know. It's even harder for me because I've been knocking out everybody in the first round or the second. The only fight I had was my very first one that went to the third round. But even then, you know, like both of us were very fatigued before the final punch came, right? And I was in incredible shape for that fight, so. Yeah, 25 minutes seems like a different animal, but I know that I've done everything. I'm doing everything that I can to make 25 minutes. So,
and your opponent here, you know, Phillips, 7-4-1 in his career, but it's been up and down for him in his last 9 fights: 4 wins, 4 losses, and coming off a draw. You know, when you initially get this fight and you start kind of, and your coaches start looking into him, was there anything that really stuck out to you?
Well, he's a talented fighter. You know, he's very good. He's athletic. He's not afraid of anybody. You know, he fought Roy Jones. You know, he boxed with one of the greatest to ever do it. You know, he's the guy. I have nothing but respect for the guy. You know, like to step in the ring with that guy, and I mean, he probably believed he was going to beat him. You know, in his head, he probably believed he was going to beat him. But that's the greatest. That's one of the greatest to ever do it. You know, so for me, I got nothing but good things to say about him. You know, we're going to go out there. We're going to fight. But I got nothing but love and respect for that guy.
You know, I mean, obviously the respect is a huge part of this game, but once that you know, that fight starts, does respect in a way go out the window?
Yeah. Then he's just an opponent. Then it's just a target. Then now it's him or me, you know, at that point. But yeah, like we'll be friends at the weigh-in and we'll be friends after the fight, you know, but during those 25 minutes, it's like me versus him, my body, my mind, his body, his mind. We'll see who put in the work and who's got the better game plan, and yeah, the better man will win.
Is there like a switch that goes off for you of
from
you know when you step in inside competition, then when you step out of the ring or cage, it's just you're just hey, I'm Pat, but I'm not you know the guy that was just in there.
Yeah, well, I do like a Facebook Live for all my broke friends, what I'm getting at is you can see me leading up to the fight in the warm up. You can see every emotion. Like I'm very different, I think, than most other guys. You know, to me, this is just like a sport. I'm still having fun. I'm joking around. But the second that I'm walking out, then that, like you said, that from the dressing room to the cage, that's when that switch flips, and then I'm a different person. You know, then it's like, okay, now this is take it serious. You know, this guy's gonna try to do as much as he can to you know pummel you to the ground, and you gotta do it to him before he gets you. So yeah, then I'm a joker, man. I'm not a violent person. I don't have that bone in my body. Just when competition comes, then it's different.
You mentioned about having fun in the sport. Outside of the injury situations that you've dealt with, has there ever been a time where you weren't having fun?
Yeah, dieting. Yeah, dieting. And you know, here's the thing. I'm more often than not training every single day. And when I don't have a fight, I enjoy doing that. But for some reason, when I have a fight, I don't enjoy training every single day. You know, I don't. I don't know what the difference is. I think it's because when I don't have a fight and I'm training every day, I don't have anybody telling me that I have to be in there. You know, I don't have anybody saying, hey, you're not working hard enough. Get to the gym. You know, there's something you could be doing. But I'm in my own head a lot, especially when I have a fight. So I'm very hard on myself. So whenever I have a fight, I'm not enjoying the training. I'm not enjoying the dieting. I'm not enjoying much of it, really. You know. So, but then if I wasn't competing, I'd be doing the exact same thing. So maybe I'm just a head case a little bit.
I mean, would you say this game is completely more mental than it is physical for at least you?
For me, it is. Yeah. For me, it is. It's all mental. I get you because like you've heard me say multiple times, man. My body's always broken, so clearly I can push my body to its breaking point, you know, and keep going. The mental thing is the one that I struggle with a little bit, but you know, it's just misery. It's not like it's stopping me from doing anything. So,
I mean, when you have that day where you just like laying in bed and you're like, man, I do not want to get to the gym today. What gets you up? What's that motivation? Is it knowing of, hey, you know what? My opponent, in this case, Phillips, he's in the gym right now grinding. I got to make sure I'm putting in the work as well.
I think it's like my daughter and like maybe working as a welder and like just working shitty jobs my whole life. You know, like I don't want to be doing that. I want something better for myself. I want to show a good example for my kid, you know, like I want her to, you know, grow up and be proud of her father. And maybe that's my motivation, a little bit of my motivation. And then I guess the other one would be, you know, if I don't work hard enough, there's a very good chance that I could get permanently fucked up in this sport. You know, like don't kid yourself. Like we're going out there to hurt each other. You know, bad things can happen. Right. So I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah. Did I answer your question?
You definitely did there. But you got this vacant title fight coming up here, Unified Welterweight title, Unified 34. As always, Pat, man, I appreciate time. And of course, let everyone know where they can follow you out on social media.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. I have Instagram too, just PATPYT, very basic. And that's it. Yeah, follow my career. Hopefully I continue exciting you and knocking everybody out.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that's going to have his third professional fight come up here, Combat Zone, on September the 21st. Is Brennan Marat, who is the nickname the Kid. So Brennan, let's start off there, man. How'd you get the nickname?
The nickname the Kid is my family's growing up, uncles, everyone. They just called me Kid. You know, the uncles come by, everyone, hey, where's the Kid at? So it just kind of stuck. So I can say I got up to my uncles and my family, really.
And you're a young guy, young in this sport. You've been competing for a couple of years. I know, looking on your Tapology page, had your first amateur fight in 2016. So what ultimately drew you, to step inside an MMA gym and ultimately start taking fights?
When I was younger, I was always fascinated with all fighting movies, anything, a bunch of cartoons. Everyone know, like Dragon Ball Z, stuff like that. So when I was younger, I went to a boxing gym just to try it out, see how it all was. And, instantly loved the boxing and then started seeing on TV, like the UFC, Bellator, all that stuff. I was like, yeah, it looks sweet. So found an MMA gym and it was all over from there, fell in love with it.
So was there ever consideration to be a professional boxer as opposed to a mixed martial artist?
No. At the time when I just started going to a boxing gym to go in there, there wasn't really, I never thought about it. I was just a younger kid. It was just something that I enjoyed and I really liked doing. And then once I transferred to the MMA gym, I'm like, oh, this is fun. I started doing some amateur fights. After like my second, third amateur fight, I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do.
Now, the amateur scene can be a crazy scene where, there's times where you show up for a weigh-in, opponent doesn't show up, or he shows up weigh-in, doesn't show up a fight. And do you have any of those crazy amateur stories?
Oh, God, yeah. My very first fight, I've never cut weight once in my life because I didn't wrestle in high school or anything like that. And probably my first fight, I was probably walking around, probably like 150. But I've never cut weight before, so I had to drop down to 135. That weight cut was brutal because it was my first time. Of course, I didn't do it correctly. And my guy actually called while I was at the weigh-ins. He's like, oh, my guy slipped and fell in the sauna, split his head open, the fight can't happen. So my very first fight, very first weight cut, that didn't go right.
I mean, do you look back at that now, trying to make 35? Or do you kind of go, what the hell was I doing?
Yeah, well, definitely, like, right now I could make 135 now. I'm very comfortable at 145. It's a nice, easy cut for me. But looking back now, it was just crazy because it was my first fight ever, and it was my first time ever cutting weight, and I didn't really know what was going on.
And you made the pro debut back at the beginning of this year. Obviously, things have gone great. Two stoppage victories. As you think about those two fights, what would you say is the biggest lesson you took out of them, and what has made you the martial artist you are today?
The biggest lesson, the lesson I took was from my first one. And that biggest lesson was trying to pace myself for 5-minute rounds, because from amateur to pro, those 3 minutes to 5 minutes, those extra 2 minutes make a hell of a difference. So my first out, I've never gassed out in a fight before, and I didn't in the first one, but I was trying to go. And I'm like, oh my God, I still got like 2 more minutes left. So really just from learning from that first fight, I should just pace myself, realize I got 5 minutes in this cage now, not 3. And to kind of just pace my time out,
fighters always talk about the term patience, and sometimes it takes time to kind of figure out how to do that, in fight night. For you, is that something that's a constant battle for you to make sure that you're picking and choosing your spots correctly inside the cage?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say it's much of like a struggle, but like my style is I like to push a high pace, and I want to get in there, and I want to be as vicious and finish this guy as viciously and as quickly as possible, because that's what gets the fans going. Everyone likes to finish, but there are definitely times in the cage where I have to, remind myself, calm down. You got plenty of time here. Pick your shots and wait for the big moments when you can explode.
Is it kind of a fine line, though? I mean, look, you know, fans want to see an exciting fight, but you have to put yourself in the best position to succeed as well. I mean, do you find yourself at all kind of battling that of making sure that, you know, you're not putting yourself in a position of, you know, I mean, the term reckless gets thrown around. I mean, I don't know if that's the way you would describe it or if not, but I mean, how do you balance that line of kind of wanting to put on a show, but also put yourself in a good position?
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. That is like a perfect word for it. Guys just get reckless in there and they go in, they start swinging, they're not picking shots and they're just going all out. There's certain times they go all out, you know, you got a guy hurt. But yeah, you got to think to yourself while you're in there, especially me. I'm like, you know, like I said, it's this 5 minutes, it's a long time. I had to put myself in the best position. But at the end of the day, this is still an entertainment sport and everyone wants finishes. Everyone wants an exciting fight. So you got to definitely find that, you know, that sweet balance of making sure you're always in a dominant position, but putting on a good show all the time.
You know, one of the cliches we always hear in the fight game is the next fight is the toughest fight of my career. And for you, it's Robert Best. Why would you say this is the toughest fight of your career?
You know, like you just said, the next one's always the toughest one and the next one's always the biggest one. But, you know, this guy, I've seen some footage on him. You know, my coaches, everyone study him. He's just an all-around gamer, and he swings heavy bombs. You know, the guy's coming at you at all times, and he definitely doesn't give you any space to breathe. So it's going to be an exciting matchup.
You know, are you the type of fighter, do you like to sit down and watch a lot of tape on your opponents, or is it more of you let your coaches do that and have them relay the information to you?
I mean, I'll watch a couple here and there just to kind of see, but really I let my coaches do it. They watch it. They tell me what to do. I trust my coaches 100%. So whatever they tell me to do and what this guy's going to do, they'll lay out the game plan for me, and I'm going to try to follow that game plan the very best I can. It always ends up working out.
How much do you go back and watch your old fights and just do the self-analyzing of yourself and maybe more of just trying to find out if you're giving some tells on what you may be trying to do in a fight?
Oh, God, yeah. I go back and watch fights all the time. Especially from my amateur career. I'm looking at the videos. I'm like, dear Lord, I couldn't have telegraphed that any harder, you know? But at the time, that was as good as you were. So I definitely like to reflect on all my fights, and I like to see how much better I'm getting in between each fight. You know, it's really good. It's a really good motivation. It's a good feeling and everything. But I definitely go back and watch my fights and just kind of, it's like rewatching history a little bit, you know?
I mean, as you think about some of your early days in MMA and fighting an amateur, how would you say you're a different fighter now? Let's just say opposed to 2016. I mean, how do you see a difference in yourself?
Yeah, the way I fight, the styles, everything. Like I said, I'm fast paced. I'm in your face, and I'm aggressive. I'm always going to come for the finish. I'm always going to try a TKO guy and knock him out. But from that time to now, I've gotten rid of a lot of bad habits. A lot of bad habits, and I've gained a lot more. I just gained a lot more experience, a lot more cage time. But definitely the biggest difference from my amateur career to now is I've gotten a lot of bad habits and I've picked up a lot of better ones, you know?
Are you, I mean, you talk about those bad habits. Are you your toughest critic, or is there somebody else that's, you know, that person that you can lean on to basically just be honest with you?
Yeah, no, I'm very much my toughest critic, you know, during training, everything I do, it's never good enough. I'm always proud of myself and proud of what I'm doing, but I'm never happy where I am. I always want more. So I'm definitely my biggest critic. Every little thing I do, I'm trying to figure out ways I could do this better. I could do that better. And my coaches, they're the same way. You know, they're not there to baby us. You know, we're fighters and they're trying to make us get as good as we can. So my coaches definitely don't sugarcoat anything. You know, if we're doing something wrong, we're going to work on it together and we're going to fix it together.
Is there anything the fans would be surprised to know about you?
Oh, goodness.
Because, I mean, you know there's a lot of perceptions about fighters.
A lot of perceptions of absolutely, you know, they're big, tough guys walking around, no feeling, stuff like that. I absolutely love Disney movies. Watch them all the time, constantly.
All right, what's the favorite one?
Love the kids' Disney movies, man. They're all great.
No, but what's the fate? What is the go-to Disney movie?
Hercules or Tarzan.
Okay.
Those are great. Love them both.
See, I have two young nieces, and so it right now it seems like I've probably watched Moana about 50 times.
I'm right there with you, brother.
And I
heard... about having little nieces do it. I'm doing it myself.
Yeah, man. It's
you know?
Yeah, but I mean, there's just I talk to fighters about this all the time. I mean, there's so many perceptions out there about who you are as a person. I remember Benson Henderson saying to me, he goes, people just don't think I'm an educated guy. He's like, I went to college. I got a degree. I mean, is there times where you're out and about and maybe you're just meeting somebody, maybe it's a potential sponsor, and they're just kind of just shocked to learn that you are a professional fighter?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, along with me, I get a lot of tattoos. I have tattoos on my hands, my knuckles, everything. And then people see that. People I don't know, they'll see that, and then, you know, we'll get to talk. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm a professional MMA fighter. They're like, dear Lord, they're like, I would not guess that about you, because me, as a person outside the cage, very down to earth, very nice. You know, I'm not a lunkhead walking around. So people are definitely shocked, and I'm like, hey, I'm a professional fighter. They see it from the outside because of the tattoos and everything, but from my personality, I'm really nice, calm to earth, down guy, you know?
What was the first tattoo you got?
Oh, goodness. I think it was 16. I got a tattoo on my thigh, actually. Back in the day, I used to be growing up, everyone liked, all the young boys like skateboarding and stuff. Uh-huh. There was the old skater motto called Skate and Destroy. So I got that tattoo on my thigh when I was 16. And I thought my mother was going to kill me when I came home.
She
wasn't happy.
Now, is the family on board with you being a fighter, or did it take some time?
No, wicked on board, really, really on board. You know, some of the outside family, no one's really against me with it, but some of them took a little while to be like, hey, you know, what are you doing? But my immediate family, you know, my mom, my fiance, my father, you know, they are very on board, extremely supportive. You know, they're at every single fight. They're always, you know, they're very, very supportive. So I'm very grateful to have a good support team like that.
Now, is your fiance the loud family member on fight night, or is she quiet?
She can get pretty loud, but I have to give that to my mom and my uncles.
Okay.
They get rowdy. I had an uncle once, when I was actually fighting for my amateur title, he was running up to the cage, holding on to the cage. Security had to drag him away. So definitely my mom's side of the family are the ones that get wild.
Oh man, that is crazy. But Brent, man, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast this week. Good luck in your fight coming up here on September the 21st. And where can everybody follow you out on social media?
Instagram, Brendan.Marat. Jets Brendan Marat on Facebook.
Daniel, there was my conversations with Adam Borax, Eddie Cha, Pat Pitlick, and Brendan Marat. Really appreciate all those fighters and coaches giving me an opportunity to talk to them. A lot of fascinating things in those interviews, but it is time to get into this weekend's UFC event, UFC Moscow, which, of course, takes place on Saturday. Early start time for here in the United States, 10:30 a.m. Eastern time. We'll start your early prelims. Main card will be at 2 p.m. Eastern time. And I think this is a fight card that I don't know how much of the UFC audience will be watching all this live. I mean, I'm guessing that, for someone like myself who loves college football, it might be on the iPad, whatnot, but, there's some names on this preliminary card that, you know, you would probably, if you just walked to a bar and said this name to somebody, say it's a UFC fighter, people may not know the answer to that, but, interesting matchup in the main event with Mark Hunt and Alexei Olenek. Kind of a tough one to kind of, you know, make a prediction on. I mean, I'm leaning Alexei Olenek in that one. We do have the return of Nikita Krylov taking on Jan Blachowicz. That's definitely an interesting matchup. We got Arlovsky against Shamil Abdurmanov, which I butcher the hell out of that name. And also we've got Thiago Alves on this card. But I mean, look, if you're tuning in to this fight card, it is about the main event.
Yeah, it is 100% about the main event. And look, the prelims to me look like fights that, you know, you got one side with the clear, clear favorite and one side setting up the opponent. I mean, there isn't a whole lot that excites me other than, like, I'm kind of interested to see what happens when Tyson Moff fights. I've been waiting to see him fight, and I'm looking forward to seeing him fight Des Green. But it's all about the main event. Mark Hunt and Alexei Olenek. Mark Hunt is so much fun to watch, an absolute treasure. I mean, him and Andre Arlovsky and Thiago Alves, those are probably the three names your casual UFC fan may know on this card. And Hunt Olenek could be a fun fight. This whole card could be enjoyable to watch. Usually these types of cards that don't stick out, that come across as relatively miss when it comes to hit or miss, or should you watch it live or on DVR, these tend to be the cards that surprise you and are enjoyable. Again, it's a tough, like if you're a sports fan, this isn't going to be on the top of your radar. I'll probably be watching this on DVR or on Fight Pass, you know, on demand. But I think Hunt Olenek could be good. I think Hunt will win that fight. And, yeah, I also think Błachowicz probably get the victory over Krylov. And, if you ask me to pick Arlovsky and Shamil Abdurimov, I'm probably going to go with Arlovsky, but I don't feel good about it.
Yeah, I mean, you do have some big underdogs on this card. Thiago Alves is a 4-1 underdog. Peter Yan's a 9-1 favorite. Rustam Khabib's a 7.5-1 favorite. Tarion Ware's a 4.5-1 underdog. So there is a lot of big underdogs in this one. I mean, big underdog slash favorites. The main event, Olenek, you know, can he pull off another Ezekiel choke? I mean, is it one of these things where maybe Mark Hunt drops him and then all of a sudden Hunt gets submitted? And of course, I think every time you see a Mark Hunt fight, you always kind of wonder, you know, is this the last time we see him in the UFC cage? Yeah, just like yourself, I mean, to me, this will be a card you go back and watch after the fact. Not a lot of, you know, fights on there. You mentioned that Taisimov Green fight. That's definitely a fight on the prelims that does stick out to me in terms of a fight on the prelims that I really want to see. Obviously, Taisimov, obviously he has issues with getting a visa, which has really hurt him in his UFC career and fighting in the United States. And, of course, Des Green has obviously had some, had the car accident, which really I haven't seen anything outside of the initial report really come out about that, so you kind of wonder maybe where his mental state is heading into this one. But in terms of the matchup that interests me the most, it's clearly the main event. But I do have a lot of interest in seeing Krylov back in the UFC, see what he can do. But this is one of those UFC fight cards that I just don't see a lot of buzz for it at all.
Yeah, this is undoubtedly not the top of any sports fan's radar. And if you're looking for things to get excited about, Thiago Alves' opponent, Alexei Kinchenko, certainly a place to start. 18-0, dominant M1, big time prospect. Could great place to start your UFC career against a name in Thiago Alves, a guy who's challenged for a title. Khabilov, Cajun Johnson is interesting. Mirab Dalishvili is a fighter who had a lot of hype coming into signing to the UFC, and since then he's faltered. Must-win situation against Tarion Ware. But I think this is the type of fight card where if you're an MMA fan, you're best served to not watch this live. And then, get some advice. Ask, what should I watch? And you go back and you watch the highlights, the best fights from the fight card. I think the experience itself will be more enjoyable. And this to me is very much, if you're looking to have an MMA diet, this is something you're probably going to cut out.
And of course, it's the UFC debut in Russia. And we should note, being reported as of doing this podcast here on Wednesday morning, that Bellator is going to beat the UFC to Hawaii, as they're going to be reportedly doing an event on December the 15th. And it's going to be headlined by Lima Le McFarlane defending the Bellator flyweight title against Valer Letourneau, an event that will be aired on DAZN. So that tells you, obviously, they're going to do a primetime event in Hawaii. So it's going to be a late night card here in the United States. So interesting to see Bellator beating the UFC to Hawaii, and obviously, for Bellator, if you're going to Hawaii, I mean, look, you're going to have a Lima McFarlane on that card. So, DAZN, I don't know if you saw this, Daniel. It's now actually available here in the United States. To get that free 30-day trial, you do got to pop down that credit card. So they do have your credit card, but you do get that first month for free. And, of course, next Friday's Bellator event will be on DAZN. Of course, simulcast a simulcast event from the Paramount Network. And then, of course, you got the Anthony Joshua fight next weekend, and then the big Bellator event. So, you know, looking forward to kind of seeing how that DAZN package does work here. But that is now available here in the United States. But it's time for our buy, sell, segment. We got three topics that we're going to discuss. Up first is related to UFC 228 and Darren Till. Buy or sell, Darren Till's next fight will be at middleweight.
Bye. I mean, this was a point of discussion heading into his welterweight championship fight that, by golly, I need a fight at 185. Darren Till's frame is huge. He has very difficult weight cuts. It's a no-brainer. And again, you mentioned at the start of the show that this guy is still young, 25 years old. Best days are ahead of him. And I think he can definitely have a lot of success at 185 pounds.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. Other news that was announced this week: Fabricio Werdum has received a 2-year suspension by USADA for his failed drug test. Buy or sell, Fabricio Werdum will fight again. Just a note, when he comes off suspension, he'll be 43 years old.
I will buy that he will fight again. This is a sport that is for the old, the young, and all ages. And if you have a name, you can get a paycheck. I think of coming out the suspension, Fabricio Werdum, it may not be in the UFC, but I think someone will pay some money to have him on a fight card, and I think he will fight again. How about you, Jason?
I will say I will buy this, and mainly due to he's a heavyweight. If he was in another weight class, I'd probably sell it, but the fact that he's a heavyweight, I think you definitely would see it happen. I did get this email from JF1, who emails me, always sends me great notes on what's being said on podcasts, so I always appreciate those emails. And this is what he wrote. He goes, Gleison Tibau equals 2 years, said he would talk to his medical team. He was able to speak with them for 2 years. By the way, note on Gleison Tibau, he'll be a part of that Golden Boy MMA show. He goes on to write, Werdum, Brazil USADA guys give up, worn out slobs, gave up Silva, but he likely was reckless and careless like John Jones. Shale said, Bones is not a ticket seller, plus says he saw the actual numbers per his contract numerous times with Jones' cards. Where are the giant sellers who have tested hot? Is Silva the only one burned by USADA since it started? John Jones is a seller. I think there's no question about it. I mean, when you look in the sport of MMA, John Jones is one of the biggest stars. I mean, USADA has, there's been a lot of positive drug tests, which, you know, also brings up the fact of Verdum's failed drug test was revealed back in, I want to say, the end of April. We're over a year now and still nothing on John Jones, which really just, it just makes you wonder what the hell is going on there.
Exactly. It is a situation involving one of the sports premier stars. And regardless of what the result is, you would assume that we would have gotten one by now. We're in September. And by the time we get a decision, the 2 years may already elapse or something like that. So, I don't know. Maybe he's going to get suspended for 10 years. I don't know. Probably not. Should only be 2, I think. It's kind of insane that you would think a guy like John Jones, or really any fighter, no matter how high or low on the card, would have some type of clarity within this time frame. Yet here we are, September, and still none.
It almost seems like the Jones camp is just delaying this. That's what it just seems to me. I am fairly confident thinking he's getting a minimum 2 years. I think that's what it's ultimately going to be. I don't know if he gets 4 years, but I think I think the best case for Jones is 2 years. And I know there's people who think that he's going to headline UFC 230 in New York. Folks, ain't happening. It is not happening. And one of the things that you have to remember about John Jones is whenever he comes off USADA suspension, he has to appear in front of the California State Athletic Commission to get his license back. Something big to remember about that one. Our final buy-sell segment is related to Josh Barnett. He did there was a story up on MMA Junkie about looking to fight here. Buy or sell, Josh Barnett's next fight is in Bellator.
I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to sell this, because the thing is, Josh Barnett should probably fight in Bellator. It makes the most sense. Hey, man, he might be heavyweight champion, but I am going to sell this because I know Josh Barnett, big fan of Japan, big fan of wrestling in Japan. I think his next fight happens in Japan, maybe in Ryzen, maybe somewhere else. I think this is the type of guy that doesn't necessarily want to be a part of a organization that is just constantly running events. I think he likes to fight to the beat of his own drum, a one-off fight here or there. I'm selling this because I think his next fight will be in Japan.
I'm with you on that one. I think it's more likely his next fight is in Ryzen as opposed to Bellator. It'll make Ryzen's actually got an event come up here in about, what, 3 weeks from now, 2 weeks from now, September 30th. So they've got that event coming up. But, yeah, I would definitely agree with you. I think his next fight is going to be in Ryzen. But, look, it wouldn't shock me if his next fight is in Bellator. But that is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast. Hopefully you're having a great week. If you're not subscribed to this podcast, do that on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. Daniel, as always, man, great talking to MMA. We'll talk to you next week, man.
Yes, sir.
This is a cannabis podcast powered by Trulieve. Quick fix on Radio Influence.
I'm sure you saw the this week that Elon Musk, one of the more brilliant people in our world, did Joe Rogan's podcast, which I'm a fan of.
Yeah.
Joe Rogan, a big proponent of marijuana for a long time. He would have to be top.
Oh my gosh. His whole
proponents.
Everything he does ties back to cannabis.
Elon Musk smoked marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
People went batshit crazy.
I know.
They were like, oh my, like people from NASA and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me.
Right. It was crazy.
It's to the point now where you want to say, you know, when everybody goes home, they're smoking weed, right? Like, well, you want to say that.
It's like, it's no different than when you go on, you know, there's talk shows where people go on and they have a cocktail. Or when Correct. You see someone smoking a cigarette. It's like, we don't get up in arms about that. And those things are very dangerous.
Way
for
dangerous,
your,
yes. If
misused, very dangerous for you. So, you know, he has cannabis, which they were in California, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
So there's no rules that he can't do that. You know, he's a very brilliant person. And yes, I always think, too, people with that kind of brain power sometimes just need that relief sometimes. Yeah. It's he's probably a little stressed out, and then too sometimes I think there's a reason for the buzz to be created, and he's not a dumb person, he's very, very brilliant. So I think there could have been some motivation behind him understanding that there may be some controversy around him doing that, but that's something
he probably saw it coming.
Yeah.
I don't think he gives a crap.
No, I don't think he cares.
I really,
about that.
What's going to happen to Elon Musk? He's going to lose $1 billion.
Right.
What's going to happen? He's going to be fine.
I mean, I could see someone like that saying, I went in on the cannabis space, and then taking what he's been able to do in other businesses and applying that technology and that science.
He's no dummy.
Yeah. He's
that's
not.
For sure.
The Cannabis Podcast, powered by Trulieve, can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.